city. Flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me.
Hello, everybody. From a nightclub at the end of the world. It is an eerily empty, quiet, and cavernous nightclub tonight, which is Sunday, the 10th of November in the year 2013. And I say that because my bandmate, my dear friend, my housemate, Doug Lewis, has for the time being moved out. He has gone back to Northern California. His 91-year-old mother has fallen, suffered an injury, and, of course, at 91 years of age, there are a great many challenges that a son, that a family member must go through, and he's gone back there to be with his mother, and I'm here holding this this house in the middle of nowhere, 24 miles to the closest store, with me and my dog Rags and one guy living out back a little ways. He's the only person around, and it's eerily quiet tonight. I miss Doug, and so I just want to check in and say that to everybody and wish the best to Doug and his mother up in Marin County, north of San Francisco, and say that I'm really glad to be with you. I have not been able to buy a new car to get through the winter. For all of those of you who have helped out, I have put $1,700 into the hoopty that I have. And I'm hanging in there, and I'm going to have to carry a little bit extra weight to keep the place open for the time when Doug will come back to a home that, you know, everybody's got to make the payments. But it's an empty nightclub tonight, so it's just you and me. But we have an amazing show tonight. I just did want to say that to wish Doug all the best and his mom. We have an amazing show tonight, an amazing guest that I'm really honored to have with us. A couple of very short, brief updates. Typhoon Haiyan, which, according to some accounts, is the largest storm ever recorded, it was a monster storm. It's now crashing ashore in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Winds having slowed from 200 miles per hour to about 85 miles per hour, but it's still a gigantic monster. We have 12,000 reported deaths so far. That is an extremely exceptionally low number, because as we know, the worst dangers after a major storm, whether it be Katrina or Sandy or any major typhoon like this, are the lack of fresh water, the lack of food, the potential for outbreak of disease. In the Philippines has been devastated. The island of Leyte has been devastated. The 12,000 deaths we know are from the capital city of Leyte province, Tacloban City. But we know that these numbers are going to go astonishingly higher, especially because it's confirmed that 5 million people are affected by the storm, and the major concern is food and fresh water, while telecommunications are down. I received just before the show tonight an email from my friend Graham Hancock, who has been a guest on the show, and he writes something eloquently that I want to say that we can all hold in our hearts about Typhoon Haiyan tonight. He writes, filled with sadness for the terrible loss of precious human life in the Philippines following the devastation of Super Typhoon Haiyan, it's time to remember that we are all a one family and that the divisions between nations and peoples are meaningless distractions from the recognition of our fundamental unity. Each life that has passed over is a light that has gone out, a person with hopes and dreams just like ourselves, a person who loved and was loved within a network of family, a person whose actions might have changed the world for better in the fullness of time, if not so cruelly interrupted. Haiyan is estimated to have been triple the strength of Hurricane Katrina, but the Philippines is a developing country with only a fraction of the capacity of the wealthier nations to react to a natural disaster on this scale. What happens in the days ahead, Graham Hancock writes, will define our humanity. There are live updates coming out on The Guardian all the time. That was well said, Graham. You know, I've been through a long and storied life. The Vice guys were here last week. It's been just like an endless series of shows for a while, amidst great intensity. But as I think back over my life and the way that I have been honored by warriors and people who I respect, I always got messages in a very strange way. It's like I never went to school to be a warrior. I didn't study a code of ethics. I just was who I was. And it was only in looking back, like, for example, when Dakota Elder Skip Mayhawk knocked on my hotel room door in 2001 before I gave the lecture at Portland State that was the Truth and Lies of 9/11. You know, he had been awarded the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and he'd refused it for fighting in because he was fighting in an unjust war. And he had fought beside Russell Means at Wounded Knee, and he honored me. And it was only as I looked back, I said, well, maybe I am a warrior, but... I find these things out in a left-handed, backward way. Well, yeah, I've been doing that for a long time. And about 10 days ago or so, a Facebook friend, and I don't remember who it was, I apologize. I'd like to say thank you to everybody I can remember. It's not Alzheimer's, it's sometimers. posted a 13th century samurai prayer on my Facebook page. And as I read it, it was one of those moments where I just took a look at my life right now, and I said, well, yeah, that's the way I'm living. But this 13th century samurai prayer reads, I make the heavens and earth my parents. I have no home. I make awareness my home. I have no life and death. I make the tides of breathing my life and death. I have no divine power. I make honesty my divine power. I have no means. I make adaptability to all circumstances my principles. I have no tactics. I make my mind my friend. I have no enemy. I make carelessness my enemy. I have no armor. I make benevolence and righteousness my armor. I have no castle. I make immovable mind my castle. I have no sword. I make absence of self-interest my sword. Samurai prayer. So we are now about to... talk to Robert Jefferson, and here's his bio. I got to read the whole thing because it is breathtaking, and it will lend you, the listener tonight, gravitas and good reason to pay attention to the things that this man says. Robert Jefferson is the founder and president of Jeffersonian Solutions Limited, and is also currently a copy editor, rewriter, formerly a talent coach, radio program host and financial markets business news reporter presenter at NHK. That's the Japan Broadcasting Corporation, big network. That's a big deal. In addition, Robert is currently a professor of journalism at Temple University, Japan, teaching ethical issues in journalism. Boy, we could talk for hours about that. Robert has previously worked as a television news anchor, a writer, producer at Bloomberg Television's Asia-Pacific headquarters in Tokyo, Japan, and is a former radio and TV foreign correspondent with ABC News Tokyo, and has reported extensively for Deutsche Welle, German public radio, covering major news events in Japan in the late 80s and early 90s. Robert was an anchor, editor, and rewriter for the bilingual Japanese to English evening news broadcast for the Tokyo Broadcasting System from 1984 to 2009. Giving up on corporate media, Robert worked on the local level in communities on the east and west coasts of the United States. He recruited, scheduled, and trained scores of volunteer radio programmers, conducting workshops on the many facets of radio production as a program director at KBCS Community Radio in Seattle, Washington, and as a news public affairs director at KABU in Portland, Oregon, one of my favorite radio stations of all time, on which I have appeared many, many times. I love KABU. Robert is an award-winning reporter, having worked at WHYY Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In 2002, he won the Society of Professional Journalists First Place Award for health and science reporting on the shortage of nurses at Philadelphia area hospitals. He's an admitted and proud news junkie, always looking for his perfect, his next fix, baby. Well, we have programs for that. He lives, according to his Facebook page, in Kamakura, Japan, outside of Tokyo, but he has two incredibly cool dogs named BB and Spunky. And he and I have made great contacts and shared a lot of information, and I'm honored to have him on the show. Robert, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you, Michael, for having me aboard the lifeboat for an hour or so. I need a lifeboat here in the North Hills of Kamakura.
You can stay longer than an hour. Your seat's reserved, brother.
Thank you.
Your seat's reserved and paid for. Let's do the journalism stuff first.
Sure.
Because I am exceptionally interested in who you are as a human being and the many perspectives that you have. But there are some burning questions. Let me summarize quickly. This will be the longest preamble that I do. But we've been watching, and you know I've been tracking on Facebook. We've all been tracking developments in and around Fukushima. We have a multitude of conflicting stories, leaving questions like, has or has not TEMCO begun attempting removal of fuel rod assemblies? Are the fuel rod assemblies intact? Can we believe any or which ones of the multitude of apparently conflicting video reports that are out there? And are you perceiving, as am I, what appears to be something of a news embargo for the last 3 or 4 days about any news coming out of Fukushima? You are close to the scene. You know your job very well. What can you tell us to help us find some clarity out of the fog?
Well, geez, you know, unfortunately, I can't add too much to what you know already. It does seem to there does seem to have been an embargo put in place on news coming out of there. A colleague of mine, David McNeil, he writes for the Irish Times and other outlets. He was there as part of a tour of offered to journalists. And that is the last I've heard of what is happening. I'm sorry, I'm getting a strange echo here, so I've moved the phone away from my ear a bit. His reporting was the last that I've heard. We don't know whether the removal of those rods fuel pool number 4 has begun yet. And I suspect we won't know until either it's underway or they've had success maybe removing one of them. I'm sure they're going to try to remove the most easiest first and leave those that may be mangled for much later so that they can show some success early on. And it's kind of interesting that the Abe administration, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, has gotten through since his Liberal Democratic Party has a majority in both of the houses of parliament, the upper and lower houses. It hasn't quite become law yet, but it's quite close, a National Secrets Act. And we may not know what's going on at Fukushima because I'm sure that a lot of those secrets that the government wants to keep under wraps will be coming out of Fukushima. And we'll just have to depend on enterprising journalists, most of whom are freelance, and a lot of them who are citizen journalists, to keep us abreast of what's going on there.
And boy, they are so useful. I want to be clear, and I want to state this disclaimer, that Robert's appearance on the show tonight in no way represents or speaks for NHK, Japan Broadcasting. He is here as an individual, but in the same breath, I have to express my gratitude to NHK for hiring, employing this man, using his talents, and I really want to thank, and I think I need to acknowledge the quality of reporting that has been coming out of NHK and NHK World that frequently shows up on my Facebook page. For such a large news outlet, I have seen some courageous and very honest reporting, and I just want to throw that kudo out to you.
You know, I thank you. And on behalf of my colleagues there, I say thank you. There's a lot of hardworking people there. Many of us foreigners, we're all independent contractors. We work for a subsidiary called NHK Global Media. We're not employees of NHK, and we're just independent contractors for NHK Global Media, the subsidiary. But, you know, many of us have been in Japan for decades, quite a long time. Many of us are professional journalists, some are not, but we're all working hard. The anchors do, I think, a very good job of presenting the news, and they've been, NHK World TV has been a great resource for many people around the world to understand what is happening in Fukushima and its surroundings and what was going on in other places such as Ketsunuma and other regions that were affected by the earthquake and tsunami. So I think any kudos that go to NHK World TV are well deserved, and I'm proud to be a part of that organization.
You remind me of an old Randy Newman song. You give me reason to live. You validate some important things that I need to know exist. How long have you been living in Japan?
Next January 20th will be 32 years.
32 years?
Since I first arrived. I did leave twice. In 1986, I left and went to Hawaii for about a year and a half and worked at KHVH. KGU, Talk Radio 76, The Voice of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And then I went to work for KGU, Talk Radio 76. And then I came back to Japan with ABC News. They hired me to be their resident radio correspondent, and I also did television as well back then. Let's see, who was the anchor then? Mark Litke was here, Jim Laurie was here, Bill Redeker, and so we had a pretty good team. This was back before ABC was owned by Disney. It was owned by Capital Cities back then.
Network, when Cap Cities was run by Bill Casey, was Ronald Reagan's CIA director. He engineered the buyout.
Not sure how far the CIA's hand expended into the operations there, but who knows? I have my suspicions.
All we know is we have seen and I can say this, and I'm qualified to speak as a journalist. I've broken some major stories
indeed
in my life.
Sure.
That we have seen the quality of journalism, say, from the Vietnam era, which is when I come from, deteriorate to the point of being absolutely useless.
A farce.
But yet, there are still bright lights that shine. So you've lived in Japan for 32 years. What endears Japan and Japanese culture to you? What resonates about the place?
Well, I was first endeared when I was a child. My neighbor, Mrs. Jones, who lived across the street, she had married an African American. She was Japanese. She married an African American man who was I think he was in the Navy. He died a few years ago. God rest his soul. And so did she. She passed away recently as well. But Mrs. Jones, Fusaya Jones was her name, and a wonderful, wonderful woman. And back then, when I was a child, I didn't have a chance to speak to her so much because I couldn't quite understand her accent, and I didn't speak Japanese. But the second time I left Japan, I went back to the East Coast and spent a couple years on the East Coast in Philadelphia. Not in Philadelphia, but in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Montgomery County, north of Philadelphia.
Sure.
And by then I was able to speak Japanese, having lived here for a long time. And I got to know her a whole lot better and realized what a wonderful, wonderful woman she was, raising two kids who were grown now with their own kids and probably grandkids by now. So from a very young age, and even as a teenager studying karate, but as an adult, let me give you a short history. I went to Temple University in 1978, but I started in broadcasting when I was 14 years old in high school, and I started professionally when I was 16 years old at WDAS AM and FM radio in Philadelphia. And so by the time I got to Temple University, I was already a professional. I worked with Mumia Abu-Jamal in the late 90s, and Brahin Ahmadiyya. He was a well-known Philadelphia journalist, a radio journalist. He also went into TV for a short while. He died as well, I believe, sometime in the early 2000s, of a heart attack at age 57, quite young. So I left Temple, and a friend of mine, my good friend of mine, Tony, had this whim of wanting to go into the military, and he was going to the Air Force, and he asked me if I would join him to talk to the recruiter, just to sort of hold his hand. And so I did, and the recruiter said, "Well, don't you realize that the United States military has the largest network in the world?" And I said, prove it to me. And he came back a few days later with brochures and pamphlets and things. So I gave it a look, and I said, you know, I've always wanted to be a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent. The Vietnam War was over, and there was, you know, no wars going on. But I said, well, this might be a chance for me to go overseas and see the world. And so I left Temple. It was all paid for. My father was a Korean War veteran, so the GI Bill was paid for all of my schooling at Temple University. And I just walked away from it and joined the Air Force and studied journalism in the Air Force and went to the Defense Department's, it's called DINFO, it's Defense Information School of Journalism and Public Affairs. And my first assignment was in Turkey, and I arrived in Turkey on my 19th birthday in 1979, and I was stationed at Incirlik Air Base in southern Turkey during the Carter administration. And from there, I went to the Azores, Portugal. The Azores is an island archipelago about 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal. And I was assigned there as a military broadcaster. I was a TV news anchor for the base, base affairs and world news and national news and the like. And then my next assignment was Tokyo, Japan, working for the Far East Network. And back then, there was no CNN, there was no satellite TV, cable TV was still in its infancy. So we were the big thing in town. You know, all the embassies, they listened to us on AM radio. And so, you know, it was quite an exciting time to be so young. And here I am in Tokyo. Even back then, it was such a futuristic city. Vending machines would talk to you and say thank you, and elevators, you know, would do the same. And yeah, so...
So you feel at home there. You are.
You know, I do. It's a strange feeling. I don't. You know, I'm not too sure about, you know, past lives and all that. But I think if I have been reincarnated, I've been reincarnated from having lived somewhere here in Asia, probably maybe here in Japan. It's such a comfortable feeling here. There's a sense of civility here. Still, I mean, sure, horrendous crimes happen here still. The Japanese are not saintly, you know, as, you know, collectively. No, there's some bad apples here as well. But generally speaking, it's a very civil and safe society. I've never had my home broken into. I've never had my car broken into or vandalized. Mm-hmm. I've never been assaulted in any way. It's just one of the last bastions of peace and security and comfort in this crazy world that we live in.
For as long as that lasts. Among other things, and one of my favorite quotes from all time was from Carl Bernstein. I got to paraphrase him, but he said, you know, it's absolutely ludicrous to talk about objectivity in the news business, because even just selecting what stories you run and where you place them in the newspaper is one of the most subjective decisions that anybody mm-hmm. makes. And as a journalist and a human being, I know that I cannot, and I have never tried to separate myself from the stories, the books that I have written. What I have done was say, here I am, and this is what I believe, and what I have found that made me do was to work harder to prove my points when they supported something I had openly. But that just sharpened my knife a little better. But one of the things that is so appealing about you is that you're an American, you've been to Temple, you're from Philly, but you're also a black man.
Yes.
And that cannot, and it must not be separated from the perspective. So we're coming up on the song that you chose for tonight's show, mm-hmm. which I thought was so perfect. And it was written in 1971. The song's called Mercy, Mercy Me by Marvin Gaye. And yeah. and as you listen to the lyrics of this song, which became a million seller, his second album went gold right away over it. As you listen to the words of this song from 42 years ago,
when I was 11 years old,
when you were 11 years old, the lyrics and the words to the song "Mercy, Mercy Me," which you picked tonight, are so appropriate and they are so yeah. soulful. And we thank you for picking this song. So let's listen to Marvin Gaye.
Before we do, take note that in the very beginning, it is Marvin Gaye on the piano.
Okay.
And he wrote the song entirely by himself. The strings were arranged by, I think it was Paul Reiser,
yes.
Yeah. And it's fabulous. That tune haunted me the first time I heard it. And it made me pay attention to Mother Earth, Pachamama, however you want to call it. And it's always stuck with me.
Well, this is from Marvin Gaye's second album, What's Going On. Here is the song, Mercy, Mercy Me.
Sit on the oceans and upon high seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Lost more radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Mercy, mercy, me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from sand? Can't you stand?
Marvin Gaye, the song Mercy, Mercy Me. Our guest tonight on Lifeboat Hour is Robert Jefferson, journalist, journalism professor, a very experienced and wonderful guy living outside of Tokyo, Japan, who is with us tonight. That was a great pick, Robert. I really like
that. No, thank you. Thank you.
I mean, hit that nail on the head.
Mike, you were talking earlier about objectivity and how we really can't be objective.
Sure.
And how we choose stories, how we report on them. I was just talking to my students the other day, my ethics and journalism students, and I was telling them that, I actually listen to all sorts of radio. I listen to PRN, all day long. When I go to bed, it's on. When I wake up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, it's on. You know, I love Gary Null. I love Eustace Lee. I love all of the programming there. Stephen Fleddon. I listen to all of it, and I just found out about PRN. I didn't even know about it. I just found out about it a few months ago. But I also listen to things like the Rents Radio Network. I'll listen to, his name is slipping me right now, the former KKK Grand Wizard, I'll listen to him. I told my students, I want to step outside my blackness for a moment, and listen to what someone has to say, just to try to understand where they're coming from, for at least a moment. And I think all journalists have to do that at one point. Put yourselves in someone else's shoes for a little bit. Walk a few steps in their shoes, and then try to get an idea of where that person's coming from.
As a writer and author and a journalist myself, by the way, we are at the bottom of the hour. This is Michael Rupert, Tracker of Truth, here with you on the Lifeboat Hour on PRN.FM. I hit that right at the bottom of the hour, so give me a prop for that. As a writer, and I'm speaking now as an author of two books and so many essays, about a 3-million-word record, I find that I take great care, and you as a newsman, news writer must also. It is so indispensable to be aware of what people are thinking out there, because being crafty, we all as writers get our satisfaction, get our jollies, if you will, from effective communication, wherein we realize that we have transmitted a message, and that message has been received the way we intended it. Right? That's the payoff. So you really have to walk through the valley of the shadow of dumb sometimes, or walk through the shadow of the valley of things you do not agree with, just to find out what's out there. And that's what a scout does too. There's a good element to that. I'd like to read something to you because I really want you to comment on something that I wrote. Yesterday, after there was a major announcement in Great Britain that whether you like it or not, people of South England, fracking is coming and it's going to be everywhere in your backyards and you can't say anything about it. And I wrote this holding in mind the recent story about a lawmaker from the upper house of the Japanese Diet named Yamamoto, and I don't know if he's related to the admiral or not, but I hope so, who was an actor, who had handed a letter to Emperor Akihito. But here's a comment that I wrote in response to the British story, and I'd like to hear your take on this. I wrote, "Things are getting much simpler, aren't they? Between Fukushima, a crumbling nuclear power industry, global warming, climate chaos, and fracking, only one conclusion is possible. The infinite growth economic paradigm, the powers that were, as I call them, is intentionally trying to kill the human race and all life on the planet. The powers that were are intensifying their campaign with a ruthless and brazen passion in the UK, Canada, Australia, and the US. Their crowning achievement will be the destruction of everything in their failing dominion over Mother Earth. In many places, they are failing because of increasingly motivated and focused resistance as humans come to realize that they are acting in pure and righteous self-defense. They are also acting more and more at long last as defenders and protectors of all life, in that they are healing and becoming stronger and more powerful. The only way to defeat evil is to change the way money works, eliminate fractional reserve banking, compound interest, and fiat currency. These are the heart of infinite growth. I predict that there will be massive and bloody uprisings in the UK against this outright assault. The people of England are being murdered. They know it. And Queen Elizabeth II's position is becoming increasingly similar to Marie Antoinette in the same way that Emperor Akihito's position in Japan is beginning to resemble that of Tsar Nicholas II of Russia in 1917. In a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken's involved, but the pig is committed." Now, I've never heard of a revolution in Japan. I've heard of civil wars, many warlords fighting to become shogun. I hope I said that right, shogun. What I would maintain with this is that, like Graham Hancock said, Japanese culture is one of the strongest and most well-defined in the world, but underneath we are all human beings, and we have seen human beings get pushed to the point where their humanity overrides all else. Those are my observations. Take Yamamoto's actions. Take everything that's unfolding in Japan. Obviously, Japanese civilization culture is under enormous stress.
It is.
Cultural, spiritual, personal, emotional, psychological. Take that and go wherever you want to go with it.
Well, what Yamamoto did, in my personal opinion, was wonderful. He had done what other people, for example, the emperor and empress will oftentimes visit the disaster-stricken areas. And I'm sure that they have heard directly from the people there in the temporary housing units or in the evacuation centers or wherever they meet these people, these victims, they will hear the same thing that Yamamoto put in his letter. Here is a man, excuse me, who is duly elected as a representative in Parliament of his constituency, and he should have every right to hand a letter expressing his views to the emperor. I don't see what the big problem is there. Sure, cameras were rolling, and you know, this was caught on tape, but did you see his bow? It was nearly a complete 45-degree forward bow. He did it respectfully. He didn't hold up the emperor for very long, just a few seconds. The entire exchange took just a few seconds. The emperor was very gracious, looked him in the eye, took the letter from him, and then handed it over to the Imperial Household Chamberlain, who put it in his pocket. Whether it's been read or not, you know, of course it's been read. But I think what he did was needed to be done. I totally support him wholeheartedly. I think the Emperor Akihito and his wife are trying to set a new stage. They're not trying to get involved in politics. He's a symbol of the state. He should not be involved in politics. I don't think this was political. This is about 160,000 people who had to be evacuated from their homes. This is about nearly 20,000 people who lost their lives. And if an elected representative of a parliament can't address or hand the emperor of this country a letter expressing his feelings, and I'm sure he wrote it in beautiful Japanese, and in calligraphy at that. It wasn't some, you know, typed out or something written on a computer. It was written on paper with a brush. And if he can't do that, something's terribly wrong. I think there should be a lot of soul-searching among people who think that he did something wrong there. He didn't do anything wrong.
And yet I am perceiving, let me ask if you are, that what's happening in as opposed to more openness appearing, we are seeing the clampdown with the national security laws, a story that just came out at Fukushima Diary just hours ago, saying that the state security police will be running backgrounds on workers to make sure that they don't talk.
A little late, isn't it?
I would say so. But
the cat's out the bag. The Yakuza are involved in you know, hiring, you know, homeless people. You know, and God bless them, the homeless people for volunteering to go up there. There was a group of elderly people who said, sacrifice us, we'll go and do it. You know, they were turned down. I think this is a wonderful chance for the Japanese to stand up and say, you know, we our voices will be heard. Last year we saw a lot of anti-nuclear demonstrations in downtown Tokyo. Thousands of people had come out to demonstrate against nuclear power. And we, you know, I hate to call it this, but there was, you know, can I venture so far as to say a mini coup occurred?
In
bringing the LDP back to power? Something,
okay. All right. All right.
Something very strange happened there.
We have seen, and I should have looked this up, there's a former Japanese ambassador to Switzerland.
I think his name was Miura or Miyata.
Yes. And he was so eloquent in talking about
in English
the restoration of balance between the male and the female, honoring a matrilineal or matriarchal society. So eloquent. And I have seen,
and that is so rare for a Japanese man to say such a thing.
Yes. And I've also seen some tapes of protest of Japanese women and mothers. Is there any real sign that this is getting any traction?
It is, but outside of the well-trodden path. In the last nearly 3 years, since 3/11, I would take note of watching the television footage of the town leaders having their meetings, and they're all male. And I'm wondering, where are the women? All of the meetings that were shown on television, there were all men making the decisions. There's not one woman in the room. But the women were in the streets marching in Kasumigaseki, which is the political, the Washington, inside the beltway of Tokyo, if you will, they were making their voices heard. There are women's organizations, labor organizations, and others who are making their voices heard and who are working together to try to change this. But officially, it's still a very male-dominated society here. But I think there are chinks in the armor, cracks in the pavement.
If there is a breakdown, Robert Jefferson, of some kind, cracks, and it's going to happen. You know, we've had Dmitry Orlov, many other people on. Civilizations can only stand so much, as we saw in Russia, as we saw in the ancien regime in France under the Bourbons. It can only take so much. If and when there are, and these cracks are already, I think, pretty obvious, major cracks in Japanese culture, how might those dominoes fall? I'm asking you utterly and mercilessly to speculate. I realize that. But damn it, you've lived there for 32 years. You know more than we do.
You know, I don't think we'll see anything similar to what we've seen in the West, in North America, say, or in Europe. It will be orderly here. I think people will come to the realization, for example, that 51% of the Japanese population, the females' talents, are mostly going to waste because they're not given a place at the corporate boardroom table or in the workforce and in society in general. They have these, you know, these what I would say are outdated role models. But I think that it will be, it's going to take a lot more time. I think the Japanese realize that their history is so long, thousands of years old. Nothing much is going to change overnight, and it's going to have to be incremental, but sustaining. And I think that once the patriarchy, the male-dominated forces in society, come to the realization that their actions are hurting more than helping, I think the wisdom that the matrilineal aspect or sections of society do have something to offer.
There are roughly 35 to 40 million people in the greater Tokyo area. Do they understand that if Reactor Building 4 falls to the ground and there is open air fission, that they will have to evacuate and their lives are in immediate danger? Do they know that?
I think in the back of their minds they do, but how is that going to happen? Where are they going to go?
Yeah.
You know, and I think about that often. You know, I mean, I have a house here about 30 miles south of Tokyo, about halfway. Well, Yokohama is about halfway between here in Kamakura and Tokyo itself. You know, are people going to come and shack up with me? I don't know. do I have to open my doors to refugees from Tokyo, or do I have to evacuate myself? I don't know. I think it is in the back of our minds, but I don't think that it's being handled properly. There should be programs in place. For example, I'm sure you've heard of all of the preparations that FEMA has undertaken. Coffins here and camps there and all sorts of plans that Alex Jones and the like have wonderful time.
Not all of which are true, yes.
yeah. But at least, you know, for good or bad, there are, you know, contingency plans in the works in the United States. If there are here, I don't know. You know, even in my workplace, you know, just after 9/11, I was jokingly asking my supervisor, you know, if there's a major catastrophe, what do I do here in this building? You know, and he says, follow me. <You know? laughs> that was about it for emergency planning.
Which reminds me of
here we are, Yeah. So,
which reminds me of a shirt I used to see a guy from LAPD's bomb squad, Arlie McCree, who did TDY, temporary duty with CIA many, many times. And he was the best bomb disposal and some say assembly guy in the world. And he had a T-shirt that says, "If you see me running, follow me."
One thing, I'm sorry, I said earlier, it just popped in my head, a mistake that I made earlier. I said matrilineal, I meant matriarchal.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to correct that there.
Excellent. I'll surrender anytime. I'm tired of being the dominant sex. We screwed things up. Which is about time now for my song. I'm going to play a song now.
Oh, good, right? Good. What is it?
All right. I wrestled like a mother this week trying to, and I got stuck in this thread about girly women songs that have saved my life, and I've got a whole list of those, but I'm not going to play one of those tonight. I may have to do a whole show of those, like a coming out ceremony. These are all my favorite girly songs. But I wrestled, all week to pick this song. And last week I played a song by John Maynard Keane. That was a killer song, and I got huge feedback from it. And so I started looking around, and I was changing my mind every 10 seconds. But John Maynard Keane had a solo song last week, but he is from the legendary, huge, Grammy-winning rock band Tool. And this is the song I came up with called Right Into, because there's a part of me that's a pissed-off warrior tonight, and there's also a part of me that's just angry for all this stupidity that's out there. So here's a song by the band Tool called Right Into. Here we go.
Brothers wanna bound to divide it.
That was Tool, John Maynard Keane. I just needed a little cathartic release there. That was maybe self-indulgent. We have 5 minutes left with Robert Jefferson. God, I wish I was a Mayan and I could control time and I could extend the 5 minutes into 5 hours. Remember, it was about maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. It was the morning after Japan had experienced its most recent 7.1 earthquake due east of Fukushima, which caught everybody by surprise. And I was sitting at home minding my own business in my sweats with the bed unmade, and I got a Skype call, and it was Robert Jefferson, and he was sitting in his home, not kind of in his sweats with his bed unmade, his dogs under the covers. And it was clear that it was just hours after the 7.1 earthquake when no one really knew what had happened yet, and I was honored to have received that call because, well, I'm an old fart. He's a middle-aged fart. I got 10 years on him. To sit there and realize that at what might have been the moment of death or the moment of decision, what honorable good people wanted to do was spend time in each other's company. And I was honored to have received that phone call. We have 4 minutes left, Robert Jefferson. I have one question, and then you can talk until I cut you off for the end of the show. Okay. One last question is, when you're out covering news about Fukushima, you are a world-class journalist. You are a journalism professor. You know the ropes. You know where to dig. You know where to look. When you are looking for stories about Fukushima, where do you go? What avenues are open to you, and how effective are they or not?
I think going to the people, pay a little bit of attention to the officials, the TEPCO officials, the government officials. Go and talk to the people. I have a dear friend of mine, a colleague from Iran. His name is Afshin. And he goes up to, he'll drive up and take supplies and things, and he'll take his camera along. He'll go up to Fukushima and the environs there, and very unobtrusively take pictures and befriend the people and learn what they need, what's going on in their lives. And it seems as though from the pictures that I've seen, they trust him. Here's this foreigner from halfway around the world, Iran of all places, and he has gained their trust. I would say go to the people and to see what's really going on. Don't pay attention so much to the officials because you may not get the full story from them. And a lot of people ask me, you know, are you going to stay here? And I tell them, this is my home. You know, I have a vegetable garden outside here, outside my home here. I'm not running away. Where am I going to run to? The Philippines?
No. Yeah, right.
To the west coast of the United States?
No.
Back to Portland or Seattle, where there are plumes of radioactive debris and air and whatever is being carried.
Dead whales and melting starfish, yes.
Yeah. So I'm here, and if it's my fate to succumb here by radiation or seismological effects by earthquake or whatever, so be it. I'm not running. You know, of course, if it gets too bad, I'll have to pack up and go. But for now, I'm staying here with my Japanese brothers and sisters.
And you're also on post, which is the mark of a true professional. You know, it's the mark of a soldier. Mm. I didn't know you were Air Force. My dad was an Air Force aviator, and I grew up in.
Mm. Before we go, I want to say thank you, Michael, for all of the work you're doing. And if anyone out here listening to this program week after week, or this is your first time, help Mike out. You know, contribute, donate to Mike and to Michael, and help him keep the lifeboat on the air.
You know, it's just good to have really, really good friends. And one thing I know from the times that I've been in life-endangering situations as a police officer or in the long saga since is that there is nothing in the world more comforting than finding yourself in a foxhole with somebody who you know is foxhole competent.
I got your back, brother.
And you are, my brother. You are. I want to do 2 more hours of this. We're going to have more Skype calls. You're going to stay in touch, but we are connected. And you have helped us all tonight to connect a little more deeply personally from our heart space with the people in Japan and with the horrible situation that faces all of mankind there. We're out of time. Robert Jefferson, I think you're going to be back. You better stay alive. I'm going to come over there and kick your butt. And just okay. Thank you for the great work you do, my friend. Thank you for being on the Lifeboat Hour.
My pleasure.
We'll have you back soon. All right, everybody. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth. I got to sign off. The universe just hasn't given me enough time, but that gives me more heart to come back and be with you next week. I won't be by myself. I got some things to get off my chest, including a great letter to read from indigenous American spiritual leaders that was too long, but this letter has to be read. I'll be back with you with that next week and more great music. And that's it. I'll see you on the 17th of November next week. Good night.